The election might be over, but in some states, the Trump campaign continues to challenge the results.
What's going on is that the president lost the election and is trying to overturn the result. He's literally trying to steal the election. So we ought to be clear and call it by its name.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Monday, November 23rd, a look at the election certification process and what President Trump's actions could mean for future elections. Plus, the need for a new stimulus relief package and what's been delaying that process.
We know that over 20 million Americans are still on unemployment aid, so they can't find a job. And yet, Congress just can't seem to get its act together.
But to start the show, in order to solidify his legacy, President Trump plans to sign executive orders that may affect President-elect Biden's future plans. While the Trump administration has been making public declarations questioning President-elect Joe Biden's win, they've also been using their final weeks in office to quietly change policies that will be difficult for a Biden administration to reverse. According to Politico, White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows has assembled a list of at least 15 executive orders or actions President Trump can make before Inauguration Day. And the president also has plans to continue appointing conservative judges to open federal seats in the coming weeks, further reshaping the judicial branch long beyond President Trump's time in office. Taken as a whole, Donald Trump's decisions in these final weeks could influence everything from immigration to the environment to U.S. foreign policy. Joining me now is Nancy Cook, the White House reporter for Politico. Nancy, thanks for being with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you mentioned Mark Meadows has a stack of about 15 executive actions or orders that President Trump can take before leaving office. Which ones stand out to you?
Well, there's a few different ones. One, they are thinking about, or they're trying to finalize a rule that would really restrict and limit H-1B visas that are so key to both allowing people to come to this country to work, but then also just they're really important to a lot of major companies. So that's a really key one that they're trying to finalize. There's a lot of discussion about taking really sharp action through executive order towards China, either doubling down on sanctions or trying to restrict apps or computer interfaces that are made out of China. That's a big one. But I think overall, the big picture is just that the Trump administration is really intent on trying to gum up Biden's transition and his efforts to govern when he first comes in. They're trying to do all these sweeping things to both cement their conservative policy and also just, give the Biden administration some headaches when they first come into office.
Sounds very diplomatic, and I'm being obviously sarcastic there, but how complicated will it be for President-elect Biden to undo some of these executive orders and actions? I mean, doesn't he also, when he assumes office, doesn't he also have the power of the pen to undo the executive order with another executive order?
He does. And so the Biden people have said that as soon as he comes into office, they have plans for him to sign, tons of executive orders on everything from public health to environmental orders. And really, he's going to try to overturn a bunch of the Trump executive orders that way. And that's actually really easy to do. What becomes much trickier is all of these last minute rules that federal agencies are finalizing. That can take up to a year to undo. You have to do an analysis of them. You have to open them up for comment. There's a whole process. And so all of the rules that are finalized, including that immigration rule that I just mentioned, those could take at least a year to undo. And that's a really big thing. And you have to remember more broadly, the Trump administration is also considering things like withdrawing all the troops from Afghanistan. That's not a rule or executive order, but that would be a huge policy shift that would give the Biden administration a major foreign policy challenge to deal with as soon as they come into office, in addition to dealing with things like, the recession and the pandemic.
Speaking of the pandemic, I mean, there's also limits to how much Joe Biden, President-elect Joe Biden's team has had, time to spend with the folks who are actually, on the Trump administration's COVID-19 task force. Has that changed at all?
That hasn't changed. And so what we've seen is the Trump administration is still blocking the Biden team's access to federal agencies, which means in addition to, people not being able to access briefing books or, intel briefings, it means that they are not able to access plans to distribute the vaccine when there's one available. They're not able to access plans about how to deal with the pandemic in the next few months. They're not able to have contact with top health officials, even if the Trump administration has sidelined those people. Right now, the Biden people don't have access to those people. And Biden has, President-elect Biden has come up with, you know, his own COVID task force, and he has some good people working for him, smart, experienced people. But if you can't access those internal plans and you can't look at how they'll distribute vaccines, that makes it very hard to walk into a situation on January 20th and just start from there.
You said that President Trump is doing this to sort of for two reasons. One, to muck up the situation and make it difficult for the Biden administration to hit the ground running on day one. But the other is to sort of solidify their conservative ideology. But are Americans really the people who are going to benefit from any of these last minute executive orders? Or are these executive orders more meant to benefit special interests that have been supporting the GOP, not average Americans?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they will benefit average Americans at all. Another thing that the Trump administration has been doing is the Treasury Department, you know, had this whole lending program with the Federal Reserve that was supposed to help businesses during the pandemic and during sort of the fallout from business of that. Treasury Secretary Mnuchin announced last week that he was going to end that at the end of December. And that's another key way that they're going to gum up the Biden administration, ending economic aid at a time when, you know, unemployment is high. Businesses are facing potentially more lockdowns. You know, the moratorium on evictions is ending. That's really just a way that it really hurts, you know, the economy. And it hurts the Biden team's ability to come in and respond quickly to try to help people who are struggling.
We know that President Trump is not the first president to attempt to put in last-minute executive action plans. But how does his plan compare to other presidents? Is he being more aggressive here?
So presidents in the past typically have issued a bunch of last minute regulations. You know, wonky people sort of call them midnight regulations. And so it's basically every administration tries to pass like a flurry of conservative or liberal rules and finalize them. Bush did this. Obama did this. That's not unusual. What is unusual at this particular moment is the breadth of things, policy things that the Trump administration is doing, major changes on foreign policy, like withdrawing troops from Afghanistan, ending this Treasury fund that I mentioned, all of the flurry of executive orders. The breadth is what is remarkable. We haven't really seen that before. And also just the fact that Trump is still denying he won't concede. He's still denying Biden as the winner of the election. That's pretty unprecedented, too.
Well, there's the denial or the lack of a concession, but then there's also, which he's not obligated to do, but then there's the fact that the GSA is not allowed or has not really moved forward on, you know, making this the official president-elect and making that transition process seamless. So that, you know, the president's lack of a concession is one thing, but there are actual limitations to how much the transition team is actually doing to facilitate the new administration. Isn't that right?
Yeah, with the GSA administrator refusing to certify the results of the election, that means that the Biden team can't access millions of dollars in transition funds. They can't get national security briefings. They can't get transition office space. They can't go into federal agencies. They can't get briefing books that the Trump administration and all these agencies would have prepared to tell them, like, here's the status of all these programs. And so it's actually a huge deal because it just means, you know, the federal government's so much bigger than the White House. The Biden administration is going to be inheriting all of these different agencies that they'll need to run, that run all these policies that affect all Americans, everything from like food stamps to healthcare to immigration. And without the Biden administration being able to sort of move ahead with that, it really does limit them and it limits what they can do.
Nancy, does it also present a national security issue for us as we are in a transition?
Absolutely. What it means is that Senator Harris is still receiving intel briefings as a member of the Senate, but President-elect Biden has not received those intel briefings. And so it means he's not in the loop on all the national security threats that the U.S. faces now. You know, he has experts advising him, but they don't have access to the presidential daily briefing. They don't know exactly what is happening. And so it means that he doesn't have any of that. And it just creates a sort of a sense of chaos at a key moment for the United States. Any time that power transfers from one party to another, or there's a new occupant of the White House, or the Senate changes hands, that's always a moment when foreign interests could step in and, you know, create chaos or do something. And so you really want everyone to be prepared and on the same page. And it does create a national security risk for the Biden team not having that information.
There have also been a series of firings. We know that the president has is not very graceful when it comes to firing members of his administration. But in particular, speaking of national security concerns, the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, was just fired. Who else is vulnerable right now?
So for weeks, I have been hearing, even before the election, that the president really wants to fire the FBI director, Christopher Wray, and the CIA director, Gina Haspel. He is very mad at both of them for feeling like they did not undertake investigations that he wanted. And so the thing that I'll be watching is, does he fire both the FBI director and the CIA director at the same time as he's denying Biden national security briefings? Because that would just create sort of a really another moment of weakness in our national security, having sort of acting or new people coming into those very key jobs. And it would just be a lack of continuity.
Would that indicate that Esper, Wray, and Haspel would not be able to communicate with the Biden team after they take office? Or would it just make it more difficult if they were fired?
It would just make it more difficult if they were fired. You know, right now, it would take a while for Biden to, even when he does pick, let's say, you know, news broke last night that he had picked his Secretary of State. Well, that's great that he's picked that person, but first he has to be inaugurated, and then all of those picks have to be confirmed by the Senate. So there would, of course, be a lag time in terms of, you know, people overtaking the agencies. That's natural. I think that what transition experts always hope, and this is true of both Republican and Democratic administrations, is that, you know, there's not a lot of chaos during this time period. There's not people getting fired. There's not sort of a whole change of leadership multiple times at federal agencies. And I think that's what worries people.
Nancy, you mentioned the word chaos. This feels like deliberate chaos in a moment where we are facing, as a country, hundreds of thousands of Americans dying from COVID-19, economic insecurity, and the potential for national security disarray. This feels like added chaos coming from the administration.
It certainly is. I mean, the Trump administration has always, you know, the president likes to create chaos, and he's always thrived on a certain amount of chaos. He is sort of always at the center of it and likes to create it. But I think that this is just a particularly perilous moment because, you know, there is the transfer of power. And the country is just facing so many things. We're in the middle of a pandemic, which the last time that happened was 100 years ago. There's an economic downturn. I mean, it's such a fragile moment for the country. And when you add on top of that, just the idea that there's not this peaceful transfer of power, that information is not getting to people that it needs to get to, I think it just raises the stakes so much.
Nancy Cook is a White House reporter for Politico. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
President Trump is losing the fight to overturn Joe Biden's election win, but his efforts to disrupt the process of vote certification could establish a troubling new precedent in elections for years to come. On Friday, Georgia confirmed that President-elect Joe Biden has won the state's 16 electoral votes. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp certified the election results after a full hand recount of the nearly 5 million votes. In response, the Trump campaign requested yet another recount, which will be paid for by Georgia taxpayers, and is still unlikely to overturn the win for Biden. And over the weekend in Pennsylvania, a federal judge ruled against the Trump campaign's effort to delay that state's vote certification, saying they had not provided evidence to support their accusations of voter fraud. Joining me now is Adderson Francois, law professor at Georgetown University and director of its Voting Rights Institute. Adderson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So how does the certification process look like in normal times?
In normal times, it's a fairly routine matter. Each state have their own procedures for certifying it. But once the vote is certified at a county level, it is then certified at a state level. By federal law, all states must have their votes certified and all recounts settled no later than December 8th. And then the Electoral College meets on December 14.
Last week, President Trump reportedly called two Republican canvassers to thank them for trying to stop the certification process in Michigan's Wayne County. And he also invited Republican members of Michigan's state legislature to the White House on Friday. These moves cross lines, don't they, Adderson?
Yes. To begin with, the move was a bit moot because the canvassers that actually voted to certify, and even though they wrote an affidavit rescinding their vote after they spoke to the president, that rescission is of no consequence. Their votes have already been certified. So now the next step is what happens today in Michigan, where the state board of canvassers meet to certify the vote, and at least one of them have indicated that they will decline to certify. The board is split 2-2 between Republicans and Democrats, and if they tie 2-2, then it goes to the legislature, and there's no real process for determining what happens then.
We mentioned Michigan, and the Trump campaign has targeted several cities in that state with black populations in their efforts to overturn the results, and that includes Detroit. We've also seen it happen in Milwaukee and in Philadelphia. Many folks are saying that these are voter suppression tactics for black voters and black votes. Do you see these as a civil rights issue?
Of course it is. It is no accident that, in fact, what the president has done is to target these cities. It is no accident that in targeting these cities, he's made allegations without any evidence whatsoever that there's been fraud. And it is no accident that the narrative that he's trying to craft is that these so-called, quote, Democratic-run, unquote, cities, which is like another word for black, are corrupt. What he's attempting to do is to simply delegitimize the election by suggesting that, in fact, there was corruption in these quote-unquote black cities.
Is it possible for a state legislature to appoint electors who vote for Donald Trump, even if the state itself did not?
By law, no, because 48 states and the District of Columbia, by law, are required to appoint the electors of the candidates who won the popular vote. And this is pretty ministerial. Now, the fact of the matter is we have never had an instance in which the state's legislatures have overturned the popular vote and chosen a set of electors of the candidates who lost the popular vote.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening in Georgia, because the state there, including Republican Governor Brian Kemp, certified the election results. They did a full hand recount of nearly 5 million votes, and yet President Trump's campaign is going back and requesting another recount. Mm-hmm. And this will be paid for by Georgia taxpayers. Do the taxpayers have to pay for this, even if the election results have already been certified? I mean, this feels slightly unfair to the taxpayers.
It is. And what's really going on here, it's not that he's hoping to overturn the results. What's really going on here is that by law, all recounts in all states must be settled by December 8. So the end game that the Trump campaign is running right now is to try to delay the process, to try to throw a wrench in the works, if you will, so that by the time December 8 runs around, he has a number of states that are not certified, and therefore he can make an argument that since there's been no certification, the state legislatures must appoint the electors. And again, as I suggested, there is no precedent for this. And we ought to be clear as to what we're talking about. Because sometimes when we looked at the Trump campaign strategy, sometimes folks refer to it as subverting democracy or going against democratic norms. That's not what's going on. What's going on is that the president lost the election and is trying to overturn the result, is literally trying to steal the election. So we ought to be clear and call it by its name.
Adderson, what are the long-term implications of these moves that the president is making?
I think the long-term implication is obviously, on the one hand, perhaps he's trying to take a long shot attempt at overturning the result. But on the other hand, in the longer term, what he's trying to do is to make President Biden, President-elect Biden, seem to be an illegitimate president. And again, I think we have to be clear that we've reached a point now where I call it the OJ on the 405 in the White Bronco phase of the Trump campaign, and Giuliani is Al Collins. But it helps to remember that basically this is going to be damaging in the long term. In long term, I think the story he's trying to say for 4 years is that he won the election and Joe Biden is illegitimate.
Adderson Francois is a law professor at Georgetown University and the director of its Voting Rights Institute. Adderson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
When Congress passed the CARES Act in the spring, it provided relief checks of up to $1,200 for millions of Americans, and even more for those with kids. It was, by some accounts, a big success. But millions of very low-income families, those who normally don't file taxes, got nothing. In September, the IRS sent out letters urging people in this category to register for their missing relief funds online by November 21st. But many Americans in need may have missed that announcement, leaving them without much needed funds. Heather Long is an economics correspondent at The Washington Post. Heather, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So who are the people that didn't get this extra stimulus?
These are two broad categories, really, really low income people. So generally people not filing income taxes, which means they're earning less than about $12,000 a year for an individual or $24,000 a year for couples. So these people really need the money. The other group that did not get stimulus money was actually prison inmates, people serving jail time. That was actually remedied by the courts, and the IRS is in the process of getting those checks out. They hope to have them all out by the end of November. But as you said, there's still, the estimates range from 9 to 12 million who, there was a mad rush to try to get these people registered, try to get their information to the IRS. But if they're not filing tax returns, the IRS didn't have it.
So this weekend was the deadline for a lot of those Americans, but how did the efforts for folks to register go? I mean, you know, I can imagine that there are people who just never got that message.
Exactly. One of the big problems is this goes back to what we're seeing a lot during this pandemic. This was a process that was really geared towards people having a computer and internet access, and in particular, people having a laptop or desktop. And so in order to use this IRS portal, it was called a non-filer portal. So people who don't file income taxes, they created a special form online. It was supposed to be simpler than filing a tax return, but you could not do it on your mobile phone. And so, you know, trying to reach this population, again, that doesn't have a lot of money, that typically doesn't have internet access, what we were seeing is even homeless shelters were begging for funds so that they could buy laptops to help people to register who are entitled to this money. But you had to go through this process on a laptop in order to get it.
For those who missed the deadline, which was, as we said, November 21st, do they have any recourse now if they're listening to this segment, for example, to get any of that money?
They do. It's not super satisfying. They will not get it this year. What they can do is early next year, so between basically February and April 15th, they could file a 2020 tax return. So in this case, they will have to file an actual tax return in order to get this money. And it should be sent out as it's either a check or direct deposit, depending upon how they enter their information. But obviously, that's a long time to wait for people who are cash strapped.
Where are we on the possibility of another relief bill like the CARES Act? Congress seems to have been in a deadlock over this for quite some time. Are we close?
No. And it's mind-boggling to say that. that we're sitting here and every indicator is telling us that things are getting worse. We've all still seen these long lines at food banks. We know from the surveys that the census is doing that over 10 million people every week are food insecure. We know that many millions of people are still missing their rent payments and utility payments. And so we know that the hurt and the pain is there. We know that over 20 million Americans are still on unemployment aid, so they can't find a job. And yet Congress just can't seem to get its act together. The most promising sign that's happened in the last few days is we're starting to hear a little bit from the incoming Biden administration that they're kind of starting to put the word out that they would like to see some sort of deal. They're sort of, some money is better than no money is what they're starting to tell Democrats and trying to urge them to take whatever Republicans will offer. So if Republicans will only offer $500 billion or $1 trillion, take it. That's better than nothing.
And why haven't they taken it so far? Because I think that's the frustrating part. I mean, I think it's easy if, you know, depending on where someone falls politically to point fingers, but this does feel like it's unnecessary gridlock to be going through in this moment. Why haven't they just taken the deal, the Democrats?
So a similar deal was on the table in August, and Speaker Pelosi on the Democratic side rejected it. And I think people on the Democratic side really thought that they were going to win the election and that there was a possibility they were going to win the Senate. And so they could get a much bigger package. And they thought if they waited that they could get the full package, over $2 trillion worth of aid. And in particular, Republicans are really hesitant to give any money to states and localities, so cities, municipalities. And there's a lot of belief on the Democratic side that that was needed, that there was a lot of belief on the Democratic side that more money was needed for testing and tracing than Republicans were willing to do. So I think the hearts maybe were in the right place, but it turned out not to be a pragmatic move.
What do we know? You mentioned President-elect Joe Biden potentially, you know, putting some pressure on Congress to get this done. What plans does he have come Inauguration Day if it doesn't get done by then?
Yeah, that's a great question. I will say the Biden team is working actively on executive orders, so things they can do without Congress. At the top of that list, and boy, is it needed, is to extend the eviction moratorium so people would not be able to be evicted from their homes. So those feel like small potatoes, but it certainly would be a step in the right direction.
Outside of a formal stimulus bill, are there any other federal programs that are stepping in to address some of this housing insecurity and food insecurity?
A little bit. So obviously we have this program SNAP, sometimes known as food stamps. We have seen that go up several million. The housing aid was another area that Democrats were holding out, hoping they could get more money for in a relief package. And so far, Republicans really haven't wanted to go there. So I think the housing aid has been an area that's been really scary the last few weeks. And I'm one of the people and many who have been writing about this real fear that in January you could see some sort of mass eviction crisis early next year, similar to what we saw in the Great Recession with those foreclosures, where it felt like numerous homes on a block were being foreclosed on. We could easily see that with evictions of renters who have even less money, and people I've written about who, you know, their landlord has still gone through with an eviction process, like putting a padlock on the door so you can't even get in anymore, even though they're not supposed to do that right now. Where does this person turn to? You know, right now in the middle of a pandemic, very hard to find housing. They end up maybe renting a room somewhere or couch surfing.
Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
Last week, the CDC recommended against traveling for Thanksgiving because of the rising number of COVID-19 cases around the country. And while some Americans have insisted on traveling anyway, the decrease in overall passengers could further hurt the airline industry. Earlier this year, Congress approved a COVID relief stimulus package, which included $32 billion for airlines, but that money ran out back in October. Leslie Josephs is with me, and she's the airline reporter for CNBC. Leslie, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks for having me.
So CDC says not to travel. Americans, some of them, are still traveling. Has the airline industry been hurt by that this week?
The airline industry has been hurt by the pandemic probably more than any other industry. Travel in particular has just been devastated by COVID-19. Since the spike in the latest spike in coronavirus cases, airlines are starting to see a drop in bookings. They're starting to see cancellations pick up. But what we are seeing is indeed there is a spike in travel right before Thanksgiving. It's just compared with last year, it's terrible.
So what's happened since October? I mean, we mentioned that there were $32 billion that were given to the airline industry and through the CARES Act. That money has since run out. Where do things stand?
So October 1st was the first day that airlines were able to furlough their workers or cut any other jobs for the non-union employees. And they did. United and American together cut more than 30,000 jobs. One of the conditions of the CARES Act, like you mentioned, passenger airlines themselves, cargo and some contractors got some separate money. But the passenger airlines got $25 billion. And one of the conditions of that, it was supposed to be only to pay payroll because airlines were not making any money, of course, because of the virus. But they were not allowed to cut any jobs until October 1st. So the floodgates are now open. Those are not the only job cuts. Airlines were urging their workers to take buyouts, early retirement packages, just to get as much off their payroll as possible so that they can get through this without going bust, essentially.
Leslie, for folks that may be more frequent flyers, I mean, and don't have like the gold, platinum, diamond status that some other folks do, flying has not been great over the past couple of years. It's hard to have empathy, I think, to a certain extent, for the industry as a whole that feels like it's been nickel and diming us for a couple of years now. So is the airline industry doing anything differently to accommodate passengers now that they're seeing this decrease in flyers and we're in the middle of a pandemic?
They are. I mean, it is a real change. I mean, you think back to a year ago and you try to board and you're like, how am I in boarding group 9A? And how are there so many people ahead of me? And just kind of the corralling of people and dividing up passengers into smaller and smaller classes.
And then charging them, you know, $25 to sit in the aisle versus the window and, you know, things like that.
Right. And we are seeing fees go away. So the major airlines have already cut change fees. They say that this is going to be a permanent change, although who knows what could happen in the future. They could always make changes later on. But for now, they're scrapping those change fees. It used to cost, you know, $200 to change a domestic ticket. So they're loosening their policies somewhat because they're so desperate for revenue. And it just shows them how last year they could pretty much charge whatever they want. And planes were flying nearly full all the time. But now the tables have turned a little bit and the power is going a little bit, I would say, emphasize a little bit, back in the favor of the passenger. That doesn't mean that fees for picking a seat are going to go away. I mean, if anything, in the coronavirus, people are probably more particular about where they sit, and airlines do know this.
Let's talk about that, because what's it like flying? I haven't gotten on a plane in quite some time. So what is it like to fly today in a pandemic? Is it safe?
Well, airlines say that the HEPA filters, the hospital-grade filters that are on their aircraft, and they cite some recent research show that it's very unlikely to catch the disease on board, that they're very effective and air is circulated regularly throughout the flight. Some airlines have differing policies on seating. Delta Airlines, for example, has kind of used it as a marketing tool and said, we're not going to sell the middle seat. So you don't have to worry about, you know, having an armrest fight in the middle of a pandemic. They said it's not a question of you catching the disease, but it might give customers a little bit more of a peace of mind to have a little bit more space between them and other passengers. The concern, and with the CDC warning last week about travel, it's not so much what happens on the airplane, but that when people get to their destination, they might be in, you know, large groups with family and friends and sort of spreading it around that way. So that's the other concern. And again, your journey is not just the aircraft. It's you're in the airport, you're on a security line, you're in the bathroom, you're, you know, at a concession within the airport. So that's not your only contact with people. It's on the, on the airplane.
There's been some other airline news recently. The Boeing 737 MAX, which was in the news back in 2019, because there were two crashes with that airline, with that plane that killed 346 people. That plane has now been cleared to fly again. Is that right, Leslie?
Yeah, that happened last Wednesday. The FAA has cleared the plane to fly passengers once again. I mean, we first talked about this 20 months ago, and I think at the time, neither airline executives nor the FAA or other officials thought it would last this long. There's never really been anything like this in aviation history that's had such wide-reaching effects. This plane has flown or was flown all over the world. It was a nearly new plane. The two planes that went down were just months old, so it was kind of unheard of. And since then, since the grounding, Boeing has made changes to the aircraft. And the FAA chief, Steve Dixon, his former airline pilot, last week said it would be, quote, impossible for the scenarios, the conditions in the two crashes to occur again now that these changes are have been made by Boeing.
Are people going to feel safe flying on these planes?
I think the airlines are going to have to find a way to either convince passengers to get on board. The American, Southwest, they've said that, you know, if passengers are worried about it, they can switch off to another aircraft. But these planes are going to be big parts of their fleets. So airlines also have another problem right now, which isn't just getting passengers comfortable with flying on the MAX, but getting passengers comfortable flying, period, because we have a pandemic. So they sort of have a dual problem right now. But there are very big orders for this plane. Boeing has more than 3,000 of these on back order, and they're going to be a big part of fleets going forward. So it remains to be seen whether travelers actually go on them. American looks like they're going to be the first U.S. airline to bring them back on December 29th, their first flights.
Leslie Josephs is an airline reporter for CNBC. Leslie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In the new Netflix series, The Queen's Gambit, an orphan chess prodigy named Beth Harmon takes on the male-dominated world of chess in the 1960s, all while learning to navigate addiction and the emotional trauma of her childhood.
It's an entire world of just 64 squares. I feel safe in it. I can control it. I can dominate it. And it's predictable. So if I get hurt, I only have myself to blame.
Since it premiered in late October, the series has boosted the popularity of chess worldwide. According to the International Chess Federation, searches for chess sets on eBay surged 273% in the 10 days after the show's release. But The Queen's Gambit isn't just driving interest in the game itself. It's also renewing conversations about sexism in chess and the obstacles women still face in front of the chessboard today.
Ms. Harmon, what do you say to those in the Chess Federation who accuse you of being too glamorous to be a serious chess player?
I would say that it's much easier to play chess without the burden of an Adam's apple.
I'm joined now by two-time U.S. women's chess champion Jennifer Shahadi, who is also the women's program director for the U.S. Chess Federation. Jennifer, glad to have you with us.
Hello, thank you.
So were you surprised by the popularity of The Queen's Gambit?
Yes, I was. I didn't expect it to be that popular. When I saw it, I kind of understood, but I think that it has a lot to do with the time right now. It seems like people are craving this, you know, insight into an introspective game that you can lose yourself in.
Now, let's start with your background in chess. When did you first get into it, and what was it about it that attracted you?
Well, my family all plays chess. So my brother and my father, my older brother is an international master, and my dad is a many time state champion. So he taught me when I was basically too young to remember, probably like 5 or 6. And I really got attracted to it a little bit later, maybe in high school. And part of it for me was the social aspect. And as we see in The Queen's Gambit, the way that chess can bring you to so many different places and people that you would normally not interact with.
So speaking of interacting, we heard before at the top of the introduction here, there was an exchange between a reporter and the chess player in Miss Harmon, who's in the Queen's Gambit, sort of making fun of the fact that she was a woman in this game. Did you experience similar sexism when you were coming up in chess?
Definitely. I mean, I think it really helped that I had both my school was a chess championship school and then my family. So I had all these like support structures, but certainly there were people who didn't believe that I was on board one, thought that I was actually supposed to be on the last board. That happened to me a couple of times. And yeah, there were also, which wasn't shown as much in the series, there's also a lot of positive attention, which we saw, like people who are excited that women and girls are entering this sport where they haven't, shined as much, right? But then there's also harassment, you know, people who are, you know, giving you unwanted attention as well as, you know, welcome attention. So I think that was probably the primary, like, thing that kind of sometimes stops girls from playing.
What does the field look like today in terms of the percentage or the number of women who are working in this field, who are playing chess in the United States today, at least at that level?
Well, in terms of tournament competition, about 14% of members of the U.S. Chess Federation are female, although that number is starting to rise with this Queen's Gambit effect, as we call it. And then,
seeing an effect.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We're starting to see it. I would say it's more among like teenagers and adult women, though, that are kind of joining chess.com or US Chess, partly because kids are often not allowed to watch the series because it has a lot of adult content. So sometimes I hear from parents who are like, I want to teach my niece or my daughter chess now. But you don't usually hear from the kids themselves because 8 to 12 year olds a lot of times aren't allowed to see it. I have one girl from one of my classes who told me that her parents tell her, come in, it's the chess part. You can watch the chess part.
But not the other parts. Understandable there. Well, how do we explain that you said 14% of the players who are in tournaments are women or girls, but what explains that gender gap? I mean, this is a sport that really relies on the brain.
Well, I think it's a lot of it is that chess is actually very social. Beth in the Netflix series is a loner and she likes being in her own world and her own thoughts. So girls who identify with that would certainly not have any issues with chess. But there's a lot of kids of both genders who just love the social aspects where you travel to another city and you get to stay in a hotel. And sometimes, you know, your school supports you to do that. But it's about having friendships, people to talk about and get better with. And we really did see that in the series, too, whether it was the Russian team or the American team. A lot of getting better in chess is about the people around you showing you what your weaknesses are and helping you, even if they're not as strong as you. And so I think with girls, sometimes they leave because they don't have that support network.
What about the other barriers, like cultural barriers, financial barriers, institutional barriers? Because we know that for many sports, particularly the more elite the sport is, the more difficult it is for people, low-income folks, girls, people of color, to get involved.
Absolutely. And one of the things about chess is that we have a lot of philanthropic support, which helps us to, you know, bring everybody into the party. Like there's so many organizations around the country that raise money to kind of get kids into the game, to bring it into schools so everybody has a chance. You know, that's one of the missions of U.S. Chess. You have organizations like Chess in the Schools, and it is very powerful. That said, during this time of pandemic, it's an increasing worry in education, and that is true for chess as well. So much of chess has gone online, which is amazing in many ways, because if you do have a strong internet connection and a device to use, the entire chess world is at your fingertips. I mean, you can watch Magnus Carlsen, the world champion, or Hikaru Nakamura, the best speed chess player in the world, play games and talk to you about how they're playing the games. Like you can look at all games that have ever been played on, you know, free servers. You can play with people all over the world. But if you don't have that access to, you know, having your own device and a strong internet connection, then it's not easy at all. So if you it's in one hand, chess is very inexpensive and accessible, but you need to have that ability to have your own space online to improve.
At least there's been some increased interest in the sport. Jennifer Shahadi is a two-time U.S. Women's Chess Champion and Women's Program Director for the U.S. Chess Federation. Jennifer, thanks so much.
Thank you. And yes, good luck to you. I hope that you start playing some chess as well.
Let's see. And that's our show for today, folks. Thanks, as always, for listening. Give us a call about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.